Current state on 90.5 WKAR, 3-0 for MSU, just like we expected, right? Well, it hasn't really unfolded quite that smoothly, as I'm sure you know. We'll visit with WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports on radio and TV here in just a spell. 3-0 in Ann Arbor as well. It hasn't gone entirely smoothly down there either. The millionth car comes off the line at Lansing Grand River today. We'll visit with UAW leader Mike Green about the occasion in just a few minutes. And for a while back in the 19th century, part of the city of Lansing became known as Biddle City. Biddle City, B-I-D-D-L-E City. We will talk about the myth of Biddle City, a really interesting piece from our Emmanuel Berry. If you go online to the Wikipedia page for Lansing, you'll read about Biddle City, and we'll explain later this hour. At the top of the show, Michigan energy policy will become a hotter topic in the final months of 2013. Officials have held a series of energy public forums around the state this year. They began back in February here in Lansing. This Friday, the Snyder administration will begin sharing the results with the public and the legislature, and the legislature is expected to spend a lot of next year addressing state energy policy. The governor has called for a statewide energy plan, and earlier this year he voiced support for an increase in the percentage of Michigan electricity generated by renewable resources. Our next guest will help us understand the upcoming Michigan energy debate and share his views while we're at it. James Clift is the policy director of the Michigan Environmental Council. Welcome back to Current State, James.
Good morning, Mark.
Good to see you. What topics dominate this discussion of a Michigan energy plan?
I think at the top of the agenda will be renewable energy and energy efficiency. You know, what can we do to transition ourselves away from some of the dirtier energy sources that we used to rely on to cleaner sources in the future? Again, address both the public health impacts of creating energy and looking at climate change and making sure we're doing our part to reduce the impact on the globe.
Has your organization paid attention to these public forums around the state, to what people have been saying?
We have. We attended virtually all of the hearings. We testified at a couple of the hearings. So we've been watching very closely the Snyder administration on this point.
And I take it the Michigan Environmental Council backs the idea of a more organized, more comprehensive state energy plan as such.
Continuing the transition we started to clean energy back in 2008 and building on our success.
And right now, one of the main parts of this framework is the 10% renewable energy level that the state's utilities, consumers, and DTE need to hit by 2015, correct?
Correct.
And in your group's view, that an awful lot of discussion stems around what should happen to that after 2015.
Correct.
A higher percentage is being kicked around. The governor explicitly supports an increase. Does MEC, and if so, how high should that renewable energy portfolio, arguably, how high should it go?
Yeah, we've been looking at it, and you look at our transition up to now, we've been adding about 1.5% a year. You know, we started at about 3 or 4%, and we're going to be up to 10% by 2015. So we're kind of on this track of slowly transitioning over to this renewable energy, and the success has been unqualified. We've seen the price come down more than 50% in just 5 years. We've seen $1.8 billion in investment in Michigan in renewable energy sources. So we're seeing both kind of a bump to our employment and our manufacturing base. At the same time, we're seeing reduced impacts on public health. And for us, it's more of that energy dollar that we spend staying in Michigan. Instead of buying imported coal from other states, we're driving this money back into Michigan companies and Michigan workers, which is really important for our future. We think that we can easily double that number. So I think, you know, continuing this transition at 1.5 to 2% a year for another 4 or 5 years would be a great next step for Michigan.
given the current makeup of the legislature, James, we've got an election coming up, but this discussion, we're going to be well into this discussion by the time the election comes up. Given the current makeup of the legislature, how do you expect this to move forward? Do you expect there to be some kind of consensus emerging as to a significantly higher renewable energy portfolio?
We're hoping that the report coming out this week really will start to form the basis of that consensus. You know, what that report will be looking at is how much are we paying? How much has the price of renewable energy dropped? How many jobs have we created? And again, we think we're going to get good news on all fronts. So we think that's going to be really important to kind of get the legislature on board to continue this transition moving forward.
What did the public, what did just individuals have to say when you attended these forums? What did just members of the public generally have to say? Was that enlightening for you at the forums that you attended?
Definitely. A vast majority of the comments were positive. These are people who were working, you know, in this field. Companies talking about success stories where they got into renewable energy and they've done very well at manufacturing, you know, parts for the maybe the renewable energy industry. But then they talked about how their experience has helped them in other Michigan industries. You think about a wind turbine being trying to make them very strong and light. So they're using all these advanced materials. All of a sudden they've come back and said, well, we're now using that technology, that innovation we learned in the auto sector to make autos lighter and stronger so that we increase their gas mileage. So really having a lot of spin-off benefits for Michigan.
An interesting dynamic is unfolding here as well, especially in the Midwest, because some other states have a higher renewable energy portfolio than we do. I want to say I just read that Iowa's is significantly higher. Could it be as high as 30% or 40%? Or
yeah, Iowa is already over 20%.
Okay,
you know, so you see a lot of the states around the Great Lake region at 25%, 20-25%. With goals where they'll hit that number by maybe 2020 or, you know, 2018, 2020, 2025. So they've established long-term goals, which I think is really important. If you think of utility planning, they like to think long-term when they're making these very large expenditures. So if you give them a goal that's 5 or 10 years out, they can better kind of work that into their total business plan so that it's a nice smooth transition, no price spikes, and trying to keep kind of their customers happy and making sure this is a smooth transition.
We're talking about renewable energy and Michigan energy policy with James Clift, who's policy director of the Michigan Environmental Council. Is Michigan at a disadvantage because it trailed some number of states in the renewable energy portfolio? You're saying renewable energy is an economic boon to the state, economically, if not environmentally. Are we lagging other states, and is there a price to pay for that?
I think, you know, we're a little behind, you know, not too much, but I think if we come out with a strong statement in support of it in the next year and maybe double the standard or something like that, I think more of these renewable energy companies will look at Michigan as possibly a place to locate their company because they'll see that we have a long-term commitment. And this is really an industry that's growing globally. So not only would we be manufacturing parts for facilities in Michigan, but hopefully exporting them around the country and around the world.
Well, now, how do you look back on the ballot proposal vote last November, though, where Michigan voters had a chance to bump it up to 25% by 2025? That went down to defeat. How does that factor into this?
You know, I think if you looked at the polling that was after the vote, a lot of the kind of the polling they did, and a lot of people said they didn't like to see it in the Constitution. But a vast majority of them said they wanted to see the legislature address this issue. So I think the public is expecting the legislature to come back and address this issue and trying to do the phase two of Michigan's transition.
Legislatively, not constitutionally.
Correct.
That was what your takeaway from that. Let's talk about another big energy issue in Michigan and really all around the world, the natural gas. What's being called the natural gas energy revolution continues in the United States and all over the planet. Supplies of natural gas and oil have shot up. Prices have plunged. States like Pennsylvania and North Dakota are booming because of this, but hydraulic fracturing is at the heart of all this success. What's your organization's take on fracking here in September of 2013?
You know, I think if you look at the oil and gas industry over the last decades, it really has changed significantly in the last 5 to 10 years with this new high-volume hydraulic fracking. We have done hydraulic fracturing for a number of years, but the facilities have gotten bigger, and they've combined it with making their wells go first vertical, then horizontal through these shale reserves that are around the country, and that's really kind of what's new about it. But the risk has also exponentially increased. Where they used to use maybe 50 or 80,000 gallons of water in a fracking operation, we have wells in Michigan that have now used over 20 million gallons in one fracking operation. So the question is, has our regulations kept up with the changes in the industry? We don't think they have. We think we need to kind of revisit all of our regulation and make sure that they're commensurate with the risk that are posed by these new, larger operations. Now, we're doing better than many states around the country, but we think there's still place for improvement here.
Is this going to be a part of this energy plan discussion as well?
That doesn't really need to be. It's kind of two separate issues, kind of the exploration of natural gas, very important, where the energy discussion will focus more on what do we use to generate electricity in Michigan, how much, you know, through energy efficiency, how much can we save. The exploration of natural gas, where Michigan actually produces about 18% of the natural gas we use. So we still import the vast majority of natural gas we use, and everybody expects that that's going to continue to be the case. Now, how we explore for that natural gas and oil, you know, making sure that we protect our freshwater resources, critically important, but really two separate discussions going on at the legislature.
Are you willing to tell us which natural gas operation is used the 20 million gallons of water? Is that on the record?
That's public. Yep. Yeah. The company's Encana. So they've got some of the larger wells going up in northern Michigan. There's actually a website that the industry set up called Frac Focus, which talks a little bit about the amount of water and the amount of chemicals they're using in this operation. But again, that's voluntary. So some of the regulations that we're asking for is better regulation of where they get their water from, total disclosure of what chemicals they're using to the general public, and making sure when that production water comes back to the surface, that flowback water comes back, that we're disposing of it safely and making sure we're keeping it out of our rivers and streams and aquifers that we rely on for drinking water.
I see the Michigan Sierra Club is calling for a fracking moratorium. The state of New York just enacted a moratorium, as I understand. Do you agree with those moves?
Again, I mean, we focus on the regulation. Let's get the regulation better. Now, some of these other states, I think, their regulations were very substandard. So the moratorium was the exact right move to make. University of Michigan is currently doing a large study on fracking in Michigan, and that's going to provide us some more information next year. We think we know enough now that we should be improving our regulations.
And part of this narrative seems to be that because of Michigan's position as the Great Lakes state, with so much water surrounding it and so much water in the state, that we were more vigilant decades ago when it came to fracking. Do you agree with that interpretation?
Clearly, we are better than most states out there. When the water comes to the surface, we require that they put it in steel tanks, where some of the other states would allow them to put it in ponds, where the opportunity to leak is much greater.
Lansing's Board of Water and Light announced last week it'll begin selling wind-generated electricity next year, en route to its meeting Michigan's renewable energy standard. It's coming from a wind farm up in Gratiot County owned by the Exelon Corporation, a private corporation. Any particular comment on this development?
You know, we think that's a great development. You know, we think of the Lansing Board and Water and Light. They actually came out with their renewable energy standard before the state did. They were one of the first entities in the state to say, we're going to get, I think at the time it was 7% of our energy from renewable energy. And then the state came in and required that they go up to 10%. I think now would be a great time for the Lansing Board and Water Light to say, hey, we're going to be the first entity to promise to go beyond 10 and show that we're committed to this transition to cleaner energy.
Moving away from energy for just a minute, State Senator Rebecca Warren of Ann Arbor has introduced a bill that would expand Michigan's bottle bill to include so-called new age drinks, energy drinks, water, and the like. Are you behind this?
Totally supportive. Okay. You know, you look at our bottle bill, it's been a great success. We return more beverage containers than any other state in the country. But since we passed the bottle bill in 1976, we've had water, tea, juices coming in single-serving beverage containers. That now makes up almost 25% of the market that's not subject to our bottle bill. It would be great to bring those things in.
And I see Pergam is submitting thousands of signatures tomorrow at an event at the Capitol, which also they also support an expanded bottle bill. We want to thank our guest, our first guest on Monday here, James Clift, is Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Good conversation, James. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Today's a pretty big day in Lansing for General Motors. The Lansing Grand River Assembly Plant is marking a milestone. The 1 millionth vehicle is set to roll off the assembly line. This morning's event features an array of federal, state, and local officials all at LGR. And here to talk with us about the 1 millionth vehicle, Mike Green, president of the United Auto Workers Local 652 at Lansing Grand River Assembly. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Hey, the millionth vehicle, are we talking an ATS, a CTS, or what?
We're talking a CTS.
Oh, well, that's quite appropriate, don't you think?
I believe it is, because that's what opened the plant.
This is quite a turnaround for Lansing Grand River here. Tell us, how many person hours does it take these days to build one CTS? How long? And how many people?
24 hours out of the three shifts.
One vehicle, 24 hours?
24 hours, yep.
Okay, 24 person hours.
Right.
Okay, very good. What does this milestone mean in particular for 652, given GM's financial situation just 4 years ago when it was under federal control?
Well, I think it's a testament of when you do the right thing. First of all, you want to thank everybody for, I don't think there's any better investment than the American worker. And when you get things rolling in the right direction, you know, everybody doing the right thing, this is what can happen. You know, we're back on two shifts now, full two shifts, and then, of course, you have the maintenance and the things that happens on the third shift. But everything's going in the right direction due to the people that put this car together every day is putting it right out there to everybody globally, whatever we need to have, cars.
The ATS, the Lansing-made ATS, has been received really well by the car-buying public, but we've seen a dip in the sales numbers for the CTS. Now, the CTS is going to be remodeled here coming up, so we got a new model launch here coming up. Will the CTS rebound, do you think, to the extent you'd like it to rebound?
Oh, yeah, I think it's not really a rebound. I think even people know you've got a new product coming out. Everybody wants the latest and the greatest. So I think, you know, that's why you see things maybe go a little soft. But this car can do well in the market, very well.
Talk about the expansion project at LGR to prepare for the ATS. How were UAW members involved in that?
Well, I mean, what you're looking at, you know, putting a standalone building up, you know, to get ready for some activity coming here. The more the car is in demand, you know, everything's generated by, you know, car sales. So as that ramps up, we're going to do what we have to do here to make sure that we can get the cars out that we need to get out. Now, you know, if you've noticed, we've got a lot of real estate here, so we can expand as much as we need to, depending on car sales.
Who is all down there today Senator Stabenow, Senator Levin, who?
I'm not sure who all is going to be here. I know Senator Stabenow stopped by a week and a half ago. She leased the ATS Cadillac and brought it by for us to see, and we're really grateful for that.
Well, now, production of the Chevy Camaro will move from a plant in Canada, Oshawa, to Lansing Grand River, probably in 2015. Any updates on that project for us?
No, what we're trying to do is get through this CTS launch and, you know, coming off the ATS Car of the Year. We'll take that on when it arises. But right now we're concentrating on these Cadillacs.
Very good. Well, Mike Green, congratulations. You played quite a role in this milestone, especially in recent years. Congratulations, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. Over 200,000 Chinese international students study in the United States each year, drastically altering the makeup of universities across the country. The film, Imported from China, features the personal stories of several Chinese international college students at Michigan State University as they navigate life in America. But the film focuses on more than just the transition to college life. It goes into depth about topics like cultural differences, stereotypes, and growing relationships between China and the United States. We're joined now by MSU academic specialist Troy Hale and associate professor Jerry Alumet-Zeldes. They are the co-directors of Imported from China, and they join me now in the studio to discuss their film. Welcome back, Troy, and welcome, Jerry.
Thanks. Good morning. Thank you.
Jerry, we've already briefly touched on the trend of Chinese international students coming to the U.S. for education, but how dramatic is the increase in Chinese international students been here in East Lansing?
Oh, it's multifold. You just take a look at the demographics. In 2006, there were only 96 undergraduate students from China. This semester, there will be around 1,000. So we're talking about 1 in 8 undergraduate students, new students from China. So it's dramatic.
And 200,000 nationwide, Troy Hale, hardly it's not a phenomenon that's unique to Michigan State.
No. And Chinese international students are the number one, China's the number one country where international students come from.
And in this film, you mainly focus on two Chinese students. Let's start with Jing. Jerry, tell me about Jing.
Oh, Jing is a wonderful young woman. We caught up with her 2 years ago. We started this film two years ago. Yes,
okay.
When she was a junior, and she graduated last December. She, during her first year, had issues with a roommate and was pretty isolated. But she quickly learned that this is not the type of education that she wanted. So she then went out and made friendships, joined organizations.
Not the kind of education she wanted. How so? Wrong major, or was it more complicated than that?
You know, and I'm glad that you asked that question, because she did change her major, which was an issue. She went from a finance degree to supply chain management, and I thought that was quite clever, because that is one of the top bachelor degrees here at MSU. But in terms of her interpersonal relationships, she went out and made friends from the international community, and she made American friends. Those are the types of things that she consciously made those types of decisions her sophomore year, because she didn't want to just have friendships with other Chinese students, which she had done during her freshman year.
So she made an overt effort to really reach out to other, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. And the other Chinese student that you focus on is Jeff. Tell me about Jeff and why did you choose to pair Jeff's story with Jing's story?
Okay, your first question is, Jeff happened to be the only student. We sent out a call through Director Briggs, Peter Briggs of the Office of International Students and Scholars, a call to all incoming freshmen 2 years ago, And out of those thousand, Jeff was the only one who replied. And we concentrated on five people. We chose Jeff because he is funny, he is articulate, he is smart, and he also had an interesting, peculiar relationship with his roommate that we wanted to focus on. So after the film evolved, after year one, we looked back at all the people that we had covered, and we decided to pick the two who were most different as a means of contrast.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, we have a clip here from the film. This is Jeff, who we just spoke about, and his American roommate, Jake.
When I go to bed, he is still playing computer game. It's kind of annoying me a lot. In Chinese, we didn't, I didn't need to talk him about what I'm feeling. Maybe, I hope he can feel this, but I think American, if you don't tell him, he will never know what you are thinking about.
Anytime I've witnessed him being frustrated, I don't know what he's being frustrated with, or maybe there are occasions where he is frustrated, and I just don't know he's frustrated because whenever he expresses himself, almost always it's in Chinese.
So those don't sound like uncommon barriers that new students to university life face, but you do get a sense of the challenges they face.
Yeah, and what you don't hear sometimes is the cultural misunderstandings too, because what Jeff is saying is, I hope he can feel that I'm, you know, and that's what their culture would do. They would be able to feel that somebody was uncomfortable, where Americans need to be told a little bit more.
Are important cultural exchanges taking place, Jerry? Or are these challenges a common feature of the landscape?
I think there are, in a micro level, yes, important intercultural relationships occurring, because mm-hmm. We have found that in following these students, they have tried to make relationships. Some of them haven't been as successful as others, but others where they have been able to break the barrier of language have ended up making some really life-lasting friends.
What's the takeaway from the film? Do you address a particular problem or challenge in enough detail that there is a takeaway like that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the takeaway is understanding different cultures is important. I mean, I was an international student for 6 years of my life, and it's very easy to just kind of group with people that you relate to. You know, I grouped with a bunch of Americans when I lived in Brazil, but learning about the countries, learning about the cultures, makes you a much more rounded person.
Jerry, in the film, you point out several stereotypes that Chinese international students are contending with. They're all rich. They all drive nice cars. They only make friends with Chinese students. Where do these stereotypes come from, and how do they impact these students?
Some of them come from the media, naturally. And some of them come from the observations that students are having. True, there are a lot of Chinese international students.
It can't be inexpensive to send a kid halfway around the world to college. Yeah, so I mean, there's some degree of affluence that does play a role in this.
Yes, but I think students have to understand that there are varying levels. I mean, you do have the affluent Chinese international student, but you also have the student who comes to us, he is the only child in their family, have parents, two sets of grandparents, who have spent the last couple decades saving up for this child's education. And there are, yes, varying degrees of economics of these students. And I think that to superficially say that all Chinese students are rich, it's false.
Way oversimplified.
Yep.
Beyond stereotypes, Troy, your film also points out an instance of hostile vandalism that took place at MSU. Explain what happened to the cars of several Chinese students over this past summer.
Well, and I think this goes back to the stereotype that all the Chinese students drive nice cars, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a case of vandalism where a bunch of cars were spray painted in a parking lot near campus. So obviously there was somebody watching this apartment complex and making sure that these were Chinese international students, and then they went and vandalized their car.
Let's take a listen to how this incident impacted the Chinese students.
In the morning, I went to take the bus to school, and then I just saw my car with the orange paint on it, and I can obviously tell there is an F word on it.
From some of the signs that they did to our car, it looks like they're targeting the Chinese people, because some of the signs says, go back to China.
I was just really shocked, and I felt like insecure, like right after this happened.
Do you feel safe?
For now, not really.
Jerry, why do you think that happened?
There are people on campus who have a reaction toward other or difference. And we've seen it in the history of our country. When a new group comes to the United States, there are some... there's a degree of apprehension, and those acts of violence may be just an outward show of that apprehension and just ignorance of who those students are.
Troy, you've said you believe you're on the edge of the story with this film. Explain what you mean.
Well, when we originally started this, I mean, we saw the trend happening, and as we did the project, more and more stories in the media are coming out. More and more Chinese students are coming over to the U.S. to study. So I think we're just in the middle of this. So the nice thing is we have this product that is able to explain what's going on, especially to other universities that are going through the same thing.
Do we have any kind of handle on how high the Chinese student population is apt to become at Michigan State in coming years? Did that come out in the process of making this story?
We haven't seen a forecast.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we do know that the number of Chinese international students mirrors that of last year. So if you just go by those two points, maybe it's flatlining.
Okay. Melanie Foster, who served on the MSU Board of Trustees and is running again for the board, joined us on Current State last week. She said that the increase in admissions to out-of-state and international students to MSU was a troubling trend because it displaces in-state students who already come from diverse backgrounds who want to attend. In making this film, did you run into anything like that attitude?
We didn't run into the attitude. We did have that was brought up. And Peter Briggs said no qualified in-state student was not being left out.
Oh, really? Okay.
So he said qualified in-state students were getting into MSU.
There is this financial advantage to out-of-state and international students. To what extent is that fueling this trend?
I'm sorry, what a financial advantage
right.
for MSU?
Yes, exactly.
If you look at some of the numbers, I believe in Karen Fisher's article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, she mentions that international students are bringing in $50 million to MSU in comparison to students from Michigan. It's large. It's a significant number. If you look at the numbers, and there are all sorts of numbers, but if you look at the contributions of Chinese international students financially last year, it's about $18 billion to the U.S. economy, and has been named by some of some politicians as a huge factor in our economic improvement.
How do you see the larger conflicts between the United States and China as countries, as major players on the world stage? Do you see that kind of mirrored in the experiences of some of the two students that you followed or any others, Troy?
Well, I think this is part of it. The larger idea of the U.S. and China relationship, I think, is why there's so many Chinese international students coming over here to study, because business-wise, we're going to be dealing with each other in the future, and that's one of the quotes we have on the front of the poster that we have. Mm-hmm. It's all about we're going to be dealing with each other for the next 20 years, so let's figure out how to make this work.
Conflicts like these can erupt even amongst students from the very same ethnic groups who speak the same languages, though. How much difference is there between, two white students could be utterly incompatible. Who knows? From the same high school, they could come and decide to become roommates and decide that it's just not working. How much importance in the end do we assign to this Chinese-U.S. dynamic?
Well, I mean, some of it is cultural misunderstandings. Mm. So it's, you know, in the U.S. we were brought up this way. We went to baseball games and, you know, we ate apple pie, whatever it is, you know, our cultural stereotypes. You know, we have that in our background where the Chinese students don't have that. So sometimes it's just a misunderstanding. You know, luckily for me, because I've lived in other countries, I can see that a little bit more clearly because I've been on the opposite side of that. But, you know, with an American that's only lived in one city their whole lives, being thrown in with a Chinese roommate, that is quite a cultural shock.
Yeah. MSU academic specialist Troy Hale works in telecommunication, information studies, and media department here at Michigan State. Jerry Alumet-Zeldis is an associate professor in the journalism school. The pair are co-directors of the documentary Imported from China. The film premieres tonight at 6 at Michigan State University's Communication Arts and Sciences building. Thanks, Jerry. Thanks, Troy.
Thank you.
If you go online and check out the Wikipedia page for Lansing, Michigan, it reads that, quote, in the winter of 1835 and early 1836, two brothers from New York plotted the area now known as Rio Town, just south of downtown Lansing, and named it Biddle City, unquote. All of this land lay in a floodplain and was underwater during the majority of the year. Regardless, the brothers went back to New York, specifically Lansing, New York, to sell plots for the town that did not exist. This story may sound familiar to many, but it turns out it's not true. Current State's Emmanuel Berry debunked the myth of Lansing's foundation with the help of David Vada, community engagement librarian at the Midwest Collaborative for Library Services. David says the story was first told by a well-respected Lansing resident.
Our story kind of starts in the middle. In 1904, an article appears, a memoir in the Lansing Journal, a precursor of the Lansing State Journal, and it is a memoir of Daniel Buck, who was a three-time mayor and a very well-respected businessman. He had a furniture manufacturer in town. He was also a coffin maker. Those two jobs often went together. He had the same tools.
Makes sense.
He also built the first opera house in Lansing. It was the same architect as the Capitol, Elijah Myers. Actually, that was opened by Edwin Booth, John Wilkes Booth's brother, playing his signature role as Hamlet. Buck was elderly at the time, and he tells the story of when his father was part of this, that these two hunters from New York were passing through Michigan, and they plotted this town, and they decided to sell lots of this town to their neighbors back in Lansing, New York, which was in Tompkins County. They go back to New York. They meet at the Buck home. 16 men are organized to travel to Biddle City and claim the property. They travel down the Erie Canal. They get to Detroit. No one's heard of Biddle City. They tell them to go to Pontiac. They go to Pontiac. No one's heard of Biddle City. A few of the men get discouraged and decide to settle there. The others press on, find their way to DeWitt, and they find their way to the home of the man who supposedly the brothers wrote up the town on. He knows where it is, and he takes them to what would kind of be Washington Avenue and the river, and he points down a flooded plain and says, "There, gentlemen, is Biddle City." And they've been duped, and some of the guys leave, and some stay. The Buck family and the North family stay and take land in other places in Ingham County. And that is how the story gets started. It then moves on a few years later. This is published in the Michigan Pioneer Papers. And then in 26, it appears in the Lansing Journal again. And it is, this is the first time that William and Jerry Ford are introduced as the two brothers. Then it appears a couple years later in a publication, Lansing and Its Yesterdays. This is four times it's been published. And from that, historians have just taken the story and moved with it. And the facts change a little bit with each iteration. But it's essentially that the founding of Lansing was on a land scam.
But that's not the truth. So what
no.
is it?
Well, that's about 60% the truth.
So what's the truth? Yeah, tell
well,
us.
Well, part of it, in the telling of it, the brothers didn't actually own the land, that it was owned by a man named William Townsend. Well, Townsend did own property in that Section 21. He owned a large amount of Ingham County. He was one of the first people that bought from the government. The property that would be Biddle City was owned by the Ford brothers. They were not these kind of roustabout vagabond hunters. They were actually people who were established business people in Jackson. And they had moved to Jackson, built foundries and mills. They moved into Eaton County and bought property. Then they decided to build this town in what would be Lansing, Biddle City, and they sold property. They sold 21 plots of it to people in Detroit, in Chicago, Cleveland, Ann Arbor, and Jackson, their hometown.
But no one from New York.
No one from New York. When the last spot was sold in Biddle City in November of 1837, there was no one from New York that actually owned the property. 37 was also the time of a great financial panic, and price of money was driven down. And the Fords were in a bad state, so they heavily mortgaged Biddle City, and it was eventually sold for back taxes. So it was a speculation, but it was a completely above the board process.
So then, how is it that Lansing is founded, the city of Lansing, if it wasn't part of this hoax? I mean, in part, yeah. Explain that a little bit.
Mostly, it was compromise. Lansing, there was a number of towns vying for it, and lots of interest. They were given the property in Lansing by some of the few people that were here. For the time when Lansing was chosen as the capital in 1847, this was really a backwater. There was, you know, very few people here. It was the center of the state. There is some discussion that part of it was to push commerce more into the center of the state. There was logging going on at the time, and to create some sort of central hub that they compromised. It was contentious in and of itself. There was a lot of fighting against Lansing.
What was it, 23 times it was
26 times the Senate voted it down, the House's recommendation for Lansing. You know, people wanted it in the UP. Owosso was chosen. I mean, there was all over the state, and they had Detroit, which was a thriving metropolis. And they wanted to choose a town that wasn't even a town. So, I mean, it took them 7 months when they finally made the decision to make Lansing the capital. They started construction right away. There wasn't even a carriage road to Lansing, let alone a railroad
by
the time.
So just complete and total backwoods.
Yeah, it was a big floodplain. I mean, thick timbered, lots of swamps, but that also makes really good farmland.
I've always been curious about, a lot of people say we moved the capital from Detroit to avoid war with Canada in case we ever went to war. Is that a myth too?
It was with Great Britain. Detroit was surrendered. Detroit's the only U.S. city that's ever surrendered to a foreign power. And there is an argument could be made that they were afraid that the British were going to come back. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's only, it's within the same generation. Personally, it seems like it was more of an economic decision to try and push commerce into the center of the state and start harvesting all the natural resources that were here, mostly timber, and expanding the railroads.
So why do you think this myth of Lansing's origins has continued throughout history for over 100 years or so at this point?
That's a good story. I mean, that's the that's kind of the crux of it all, is that this is... It morphed into an American tall tale. I mean, there is a lot of factual elements to it, and then you add a little bit of shenanigans going on, and Buck actually moves himself because his father, who was also Daniel Buck, he makes his father part of the story. His father didn't come until 37, and it looks like he came alone, but now his father's part of the story too, so it's part of the family narrative. He was probably told the story by his father and embellished it a little bit, and with each telling, it gets embellished a little bit more.
So what happened to the space that the two Ford brothers did end up selling to the settlers, and the settlement just kind of fell apart or dissolved? What was that space eventually used for?
That's a Rio Town now. So that's mostly where Rio Town is. Factory was built there. That's where the new Board of Water and Light facility is at. So, I mean, Biddle City's thriving. It's just not called Biddle City now.
Lovely. Well, David Voda is a community engagement librarian at the Midwest Collaborative for Library Services. Thank you so much for debunking this myth that we've carried on for 100 years or so.
Thanks a lot. It was a swell time.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Spartan football's offense showed up Saturday, and the contrast from 2 days ago and our first two games was noticeable. Here to talk about where MSU stands between Youngstown State and Notre Dame, WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports on radio and on television. What do you make of this offense surging the way it did on Saturday? How do you explain it?
Well, I tell you what, Mark. First of all, finally, we've been waiting for this MSU offense to show some sort of spark, at the beginning of the season, and it finally happened on Saturday. And 55. I was sitting in the press box, and I looked at the scoreboard, and I was kind of shocked. At one moment to see that, wow, over 50 points, which is, I think, it tied the highest total in the D'Antonio era for quite some time. Mm-hmm. I believe when his first year when he came here at MSU when he played at UAB. But, man, I'm sitting there like, finally we saw. And if you look at that entire game, both offensively, defensively, I mean, play from the running backs to the receivers to special teams, everything that could have went right for MSU went right that day. And they needed a game like that, frankly, due to what everything happened with the first two games.
But were they just better able to execute the basics?
Yeah, I think so. But you know what, Mark? When you look at this game, even though MSU, don't get me wrong, great performance all around from them. It does a lot confidence-wise for this team, especially sure. When you have Notre Dame coming up this Saturday. But again, we got to put it in perspective. It is Youngstown State. Not to say, if you look at those first two games, I mean, you talk about Western Michigan University, you talk about USF, those two programs by no means are premier college football programs. Neither is Youngstown State. And to see what they did those first two games and struggle and to come into Youngstown State and perform the way they did, it does a lot confidence-wise, but you got to put it in perspective. Mm-hmm. It is just Youngstown State. So,
how badly would Connor Cook have to struggle against Notre Dame next Saturday before they consider bringing somebody else in? Is he going to really have to be in a hole here, or will they be quicker to bring in, say, Andrew Maxwell?
You know what, Mark? I think he will really have to be in a hole to see a Maxwell or a Tyler O'Connor go out there. And the reason being, if you looked at Mark D'Antonio's press conference afterwards, and the first thing that he said when he came out, one of the first things he said when he came out, of course, from the media, our first question was, okay, is Cook the guy? And D'Antonio said flat out, yes, he's our number one guy. Yeah. He's our man. And looking at D'Antonio, he's a loyal guy. And looking at the performance Cook had, it kind of just validates that, D'Antonio wants to go with this kid. It's been, harped around in preseason training camp that possibly Cook could be that guy. Even last year, if you look at, when Andrew Maxwell was struggling. So I really think from this standpoint right now, Connor Cook will be your starting quarterback for the rest of the season. We have to take a lot, Mark.
Is Maxwell number two?
That's the question that's up in the air. For me, I don't think that Maxwell's the number two guy. I really think that Maxwell has – they've squeezed all of the juice out of that sponge that they could with Maxwell. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to see that, okay, we tried Maxwell. I mean, he was a starter all last season, Mark. And to see him coming into this season with this whole quarterback controversy, I mean, he didn't play well enough to earn that starting job. I really think Maxwell may be your number three guy, to be honest with you. I think Tyler O'Connor is possibly that number two guy. But again, you never know with Antonio. His loyalty is unmatched when it comes to his players. So
you didn't mention Damian Terry. Are you saying that Damian Terry will likely remain a redshirt?
He will, from what I'm hearing in the buzz around, you know, the assistant coaches for MSU. He's going to remain a redshirt.
Okay. Did the defense play as well on Saturday as it has the last couple? They weren't as instrumental in winning the game, it sounds
right.
like, but did they play as well as they have?
They did. The defense, in my eyes, I mean, if you look at a guy like Shalique Calhoun, who I talked about, you know, on last week's show, I mean, he's everywhere.
First game without a touchdown.
Exactly. And then you look at, even with Isaiah Lewis being out, and you have Williamson in there, you know, filling in for him, R.J. Williamson in there, he played fantastic. I didn't expect that. But that defense is so consistent, Mark. They kind of really got overshadowed in that game. Just because you put up 55 points on offense, I mean, you kind of ignore the defense on it to a regard.
What will you be watching in South Bend most closely?
Well, to be quite frank with you, I got to go back to that quarterback. I want to see if Connor Cook, if this is going to be a shell shock moment for him. I mean, they've had lollipop games, Mark. They've played USF. They've played Western. They played Youngstown State. Now you get to play a big dog in Notre Dame to see what this kid really has and to see really where this team stands as of right now, as a whole. So that's what I'll be looking at.
And tell us who's on the TV show Thursday night.
Yes, Mo Pete, Morris Peterson, former Spartan hoop great, of course, in that 2000 championship team. He will be sitting down with me on Current Sports TV. If you want to be a part of the audience, go to WKAR.org. We film Wednesday night at 6 p.m. if you want to sign up for that. It'll air Thursday at 10 p.m. on WKAR-TV.
Very good. Al Martin, host of Current Sports on WKAR-TV, and the radio show airs every weekday, 1 p.m. on AM 870. Thanks, Al.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mark.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we continue our Detroit Water Renaissance series with a look at the impact of Detroit's industry on the Rouge River. We also learn more about new urbanism, the international movement to end suburban sprawl and urban disinvestment. All that and more Tuesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.